Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on March 19th during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleform conference call on the Keystone Pipeline. My name is Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Before we begin, please note that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers today. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We have two experts to discuss today's topics, Dr. Daniel Simmons and Professor Mark Scalacci. Each will make opening remarks of 6 to 8 minutes, although we're going to give some couple extra minutes for Mr. Simmons to give us some background on the matter, and then we're going to take questions from the call-in audience. Daniel Simmons is Director of State Affairs for the Institute for Energy Research, where he oversees their energy research and outreach at the state level. He's previously worked for the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and on the Hill, where he handled endangered species and forestry issues. Mr. Scalacci is the director of Natural Resources Law Center at the University of Colorado Law School. He also taught at the University of Toledo College of Law and the University of Wyoming College of Law. Former Fulbright scholar and the author or co-author of numerous articles and books on natural resources and environmental law. Mr. Simmons, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Sure thing. And thanks for the opportunity to talk about the Keystone XL pipeline. It's an interesting political issue, I think, more than anything else. And the background is that in 2008, TransCanada, which is a pipeline company, they filed a petition with the State Department to build a pipeline from Alberta, from Hardisty, Alberta, to Cushing, Oklahoma, and then on to from Cushing to the Gulf Coast, called the Keystone XL pipeline. The purpose of the pipeline is to transport oil sands, the oil or the bitumen, which is the name of the product from oil sands, from the from Alberta to Cushing and the refineries in that area, and also down to the Gulf Coast, because currently there is a glut of oil in the Midwest around Cushing. The prices are much lower for oil because there is much oil being produced in North Dakota, and besides the oil coming out of the oil sands. So they filed a petition, and you know, it kind of sounds strange that it's the State Department that is involved, but there is no federal law on oil pipeline siting. There are federal laws on oil pipeline safety, but not on oil pipeline siting. And the only controlling legal authority here is Executive Order 13337, which really asks what is, well, as these things are, I mean, it's a simple question, but is this, does the pipeline, quote, serve the national interest? And of course, that is not a defined term, what the national interest is. The State Department then took more than 3 years to do the necessary environmental work, including environmental impact statements, because this is a major federal action, so they would have to comply with NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. And at the end of those 3 years, as the time was just about to the end of the 3 years, there started to be more and more environmental protests from environmental groups to push the Obama administration not to to reject the pipeline application. And for a long time, it had been seen, I believe, by many that it would be a slam dunk. And so the pipeline, I mean, first of all, President Obama in November, after the protest, he announced that they were going to essentially go back to the drawing board on a couple different routes. 14 different routes have been studied in the EIS. They decided to look at some other routes, and that was the beginning of a new political fight, where Congress then passed a law. They included it in a must-sign bill. I don't remember which one, unfortunately. That bill President Obama signed that said that President Obama then had 3 months to make a new decision. Then on January 18th of this year, President Obama rejected the pipeline, saying that, you know, this artificial deadline didn't give him enough time to properly, didn't give him and nor the State Department enough time to properly study the pipeline. So, I mean, that's the background about how we got to where we are today. And my personal take on the pipeline is the pro argument, and I'm pro pipeline, is that, I mean, it would be in the national interest for some pretty simple reasons, I think. And one, I think this oil is going to be produced whether or not there is a Keystone XL pipeline. When oil is over $100 a barrel, it's too valuable to and won't stay in the ground. Whether it is a pipeline through Alberta, which would be difficult to do because through British Columbia. British Columbia is much more environmentally minded than Alberta, and that would be tough, but it is possible. Or whether the oil is transported by trains, by trucks, et cetera, across the border. Because one of the strange things is if this pipeline hadn't crossed, if the oil would be crossing on train across the border, this wouldn't even be an issue, and the pipeline would be being built today. Also, it is my preference that we would get oil from Canada than from overseas. I think that would be in the national interest. Then on the environmental issues, the pipelines are the safest way to transport oil. They're safer than transporting it by tanker, by train, by truck, by barge. We already have 200,000 miles of pipeline in this country, and about 50,000 to 60,000 miles of crude oil pipelines. One of the concerns is that the pipeline would cross the Ogallala Aquifer. That's not necessarily true, I don't think, with the newer TransCanada comes back with when they look at rerouting the project. But it could cross the Ogallala Aquifer, and that concerns many. But what is not frequently brought up in that conversation is that there are already 25,000 miles of petroleum pipelines that cross the Ogallala Aquifer. And then we can get into some. The pipeline would definitely create jobs. It is a $7 billion pipeline. It wouldn't create TransCanada. They said that it would create 20,000 jobs. It turns out when you look at the numbers, that is 20,000 job years. So if you have one job for 2 years, that would be two jobs. And I mean that's an overstatement of the number of jobs that would be created. But it would definitely create jobs. You don't build a $7 billion pipeline without creating jobs, as well as jobs at U.S. refineries to refine the oil. So I believe I've used up my time, and we'll discuss.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons. Let's turn now for opening remarks from Professor Scalacci.
Thank you, Dean. And let me begin, I guess, by just saying that I'm not necessarily opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline, but I don't believe that we currently have sufficient information to approve the pipeline, certainly to make a determination that the pipeline is in the national interest. Let me touch on a few points, and hopefully we can elaborate during the Q&A. First, part of the argument in favor of the pipeline is that we need additional oil reserves. We need to produce, as has already been stated, perhaps we should get more oil from Canada. You know, the evidence here is, I think, equivocal. We know that domestic production is up, even without Keystone. We know that consumption is down. The EIA has estimated that consumption is going to go up, but the trends are really in the other direction. And because of the Obama administration's new standards for fuel efficiency in automobiles and passenger vehicles, the trend to less consumption of oil seems to be likely to continue. And so I think that needs to be explored in greater detail. Second, there are a host of externalities that were not addressed in the EIS process and that really need to be addressed before we know what the consequences of this pipeline are going to be. A lot of concerns been raised about the route and the environmental impacts associated with the route, and certainly those are significant questions. But there are many other issues beyond that that I think have not been adequately addressed. The development of the tar sands in Canada is destroying a large portion of boreal forest in Canada. There are costs associated with that that are not, there's no effort to try to identify those, quantify those in a significant way. Same with the spills that are likely to occur. We've seen spills from tar sands in other situations that certainly have cost to not just the company in terms of fixing the problem, but to the environment and to the public that is affected by those costs. And I think most importantly, there are significant questions about the impacts from climate change. The EIS suggests that, well, we don't have enough information to know what's significant or how to analyze this. But in fact, there are a number of entities that have engaged in life cycle analysis and have discussed ways that these can be considered in environmental assessments. It wasn't done here. There's no effort to either quantify the greenhouse gas emissions, which are substantial, much more substantial than from conventional oil and gas development, or to put a price on that. There have been some studies suggesting a wide range of prices. This is certainly an area of great uncertainty. We don't know what the price ought to be for emitting carbon or other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, but certainly it's not free. And there's no effort to try to quantify that in a way that we can know whether it makes sense to develop this oil and gas. And then finally, I'd point out that while the big argument in favor of this pipeline is because of our need for additional domestic production or production from friendly countries like Canada, it's not at all clear that the oil that would be produced as a result of this pipeline will come to the United States. In fact, the company that is promoting the pipeline intends to have this taken down to Port Arthur in the south, and at Port Arthur is a free foreign trade zone, which means that they won't have to pay taxes, U.S. taxes, on the oil that's refined at the refineries down at Port Arthur. That refinery is basically going to be sending oil to the world market. There is a world market for oil. It's not at all clear that the United States will benefit in any significant way from this production. And so I think those questions need to be addressed much more thoroughly than they have been addressed now. I want to just add one last point, I guess, and then we can have some discussion, I hope. This is not a question of whether we're going to be producing oil from the tar sands. We're already producing about, I think it's the figure that I've seen most recently, is about 1.5 million barrels per day. And there is currently capacity in existing pipelines for about 2 billion barrels per day. Keystone would add another 1 billion barrels per day, and this is out of the about 20 billion barrels per day that the United States consumes. So, there already is substantial production. About 1 million of that comes to the United States already. More will likely come in the future with or without the Keystone Pipeline. And so it's not a question of producing. It's a question of whether or not the United States really believes that this pipeline is in our national interest. I don't think the case has been made yet.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor. Let's go back to Mr. Simmons for a response.
Sure. On the issue about whether or not we need this pipeline, I mean, this is I think that is really a question for the market in terms of, do we need the extra oil capacity? Or, I mean, as the professor noted, we have oil use in this country, gasoline consumption has decreased for about 5 years running. That's undoubtedly true. Whether or not we need the pipeline because of that, I think that is a question where I would, instead of making that a political question, my preference is for TransCanada to be betting their $7 billion that they think that they have it right, as opposed to it being political. On the issue of greenhouse gas emissions, it is true that the producing gasoline from oil sands, oil resulting carbon dioxide emissions are about 5 to 15% higher, from what I've read, than conventional oil. One of the interesting things is that, and if you were to burn all 1.7 trillion barrels of oil in Canada, that would increase global temperatures by about 0.6 of a degree Celsius, which has people concerned that if you think that an increase of 2 degrees Celsius would be catastrophic climate change. So 1/4 of that, essentially. My math is wrong there, isn't it? No, it isn't. About 1/4 of that is obviously troubling. The problem is that it would take, even if you were to triple the current level of production, it would take 1,000 years to burn all that oil, and the fate of the climate will be decided well before then, because of the burning of coal, for example, around the world. So greenhouse gas issues, that is an issue. And if you were to look at the greenhouse gas impact of every year, it would be about 1/10,000 of a degree Celsius every year from the importation of oil through the Keystone XL pipeline. That would, if all that oil were burned every year, it would increase global temperatures by about 1/10,000 of a degree. I mean, obviously that's not nothing, but it isn't a it's not having a large global impact. And since that, after all, is the entire point of greenhouse gas emissions, is increasing global temperatures. On the issue of export, I mean, it's an issue that I find interesting in that. I mean, it's strange for TransCanada to build a pipeline that's 1,700 miles from Alberta to the Gulf Coast with the point of exporting oil. Some of it will be exported. I don't think that the majority will be, but it's obviously much closer to build a pipeline 800 miles to the Pacific, where they would have easier access to Pacific markets, to East Asia Pacific and India, China. So, and lastly, there is, besides the pipeline, just by being, once the pipeline is built, people will then be, TransCanada will then be paying property taxes everywhere where the pipeline runs, which is obviously beneficial to the areas that it runs through, and that's only fair because of, as the professor noted, the possibilities of oil spills and other impacts such as that. But those are some quick responses I had.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Simmons. Professor Scalacci, you want to take a minute or two to respond?
Well, if we have questions, I'd be happy to go to questions. Or
we do have a couple questions lined up, so why don't we do that? We're going to take the questions in the order in which they were entered on our computer system. Again, if you have a question, indicate so by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. With that, let's go to the first question.
Hi, I'm a member of my firm's energy section. I was curious about a statement that Professor Scalacci made, that there's an issue about the environmental impact statement, concerns about greenhouse gases and the royal forest in Canada. Canada is going to produce these oil sands anyway. Now, we can speculate about whether they're ever going to be able to build it through British Columbia or what have you, but what statutory or constitutional authority does the State Department have to decide that something that Canada does might not be smart for Canada, and therefore we can't import the goods? And then, you know, follow up, and I think, you know, perhaps Mr. Simmons has already addressed this, but what business does the federal government have deciding that an oil company may or may not be making a smart move with respect to its investment? And third, I'd point out that the current gasoline price spike has got to do with in fact, a lack of pipeline coming down from either Canada or from Cushing, Oklahoma, to those Port Arthur refineries. And we've had an announcement this week that a couple major refineries on the East Coast are shutting down because Sunoco is going to be closing down because they can't meet current environmental standards. Gasoline is going to get worse, not better. So I'm curious what statutory or constitutional authority the State Department has for blocking this sort of program?
Go right ahead, Professor.
Yeah,
Scolacci.
Sure. So this is Mark Scolacci. Good questions. And let me just say first regarding the argument that Canada is going to produce these tar sands oils anyway, As I acknowledge, they indeed are producing them now. The question is whether we want to promote the acceleration of these tar sands oil resources in the way that Keystone XL would certainly do. I don't know that there's any particular statutory or constitutional authority at stake here. The question is whether or not the approval of the pipeline is in the national interest. As was already pointed out, this is required by an executive order signed many years ago now for the State Department to determine whether this is in the national interest. And I think that it's fair for the federal government to ask whether or not allowing a foreign company to put a pipeline through the United States, all the way through the United States from north to south, is really in the national interest. As I said at the opening, I'm not at this point prepared to say that it's not. I just don't think the case has been made yet. And I think that we owe it to the citizens of this country to ensure that the case is made before we go ahead and approve this this pipeline. Whether or not you know, we ought to interfere with the market and let businesses make their own decision, I think absolutely we have an obligation, again, to the United States to make sure this is in the national interest. It is not our rule to necessarily allow anyone from any other country to engage in activities that could be harmful, not only to the citizens of the United States, but more broadly to the globe. And, you know, we've heard figures cited about the impacts of greenhouse gases. I know others claim that the impacts will be much more substantial than was suggested earlier. Let me only say about that, that it's not in the environmental impact statement that was done. We don't have an adequate analysis in the environmental impact statement that would let the public know and have an opportunity to comment on these questions so that we can try to get to the truth about that particular matter.
That argument seeks to prove a negative, and it's a specious argument, and it can't be proved.
Well, you know, I totally disagree with you on that point. There are plenty of studies that have been done quantifying the amount of emissions, greenhouse gas emissions in a life cycle, and there are plenty of studies that are being done now and that have been done that quantify the cost to society, the social cost of carbon is the sort of phrase that's typically used, associated with greenhouse gas emissions. We can quantify the emissions that come there, and we can at least give a range of estimates what those costs to society are going to be. And, you know, it seems to me that a thorough environmental assessment would assess those costs, quantify them, and give the public a chance to weigh in as to whether or not.
But compared to what? But I keep coming back to, if Canada is going to produce these anyway, what costs are being saved?
You know, the argument, of course, that Canada makes is that they're going to produce them anyway, but it would be much cheaper and much easier to build the pipeline to the West Coast.
And it would save
less than half the distance. And they're not doing it in part because I don't know that they would be able to get it through British Columbia.
Now, well, respectfully, they'd also have to tanker it to China.
Well, we tank oil all over the world.
Precisely. And isn't it cheaper to do by pipeline than if you're really worried about greenhouse gases?
I think that the tanker ships, the reason we have a global market for oil is that the cost of transportation is relatively inexpensive. You can move it at a relatively small cost, which is why, I mean, if you compare the cost of gas with the cost of oil, the price of gas versus the price of oil, you would see that the price of gas has spiked in ways that, the price of oil has spiked in ways that gas has not, because you cannot easily transport natural gas. And so the markets for natural gas have been much more localized than the markets for oil. So.
Well, the price for natural gas has gone from $14 to $2.50. It's probably It's about $2.30 today.
Right.
So the argument that natural gas doesn't spike, it's a supply and demand issue. And if people don't have oil, they're going to tanker.
That the reason that we haven't seen that with oil is because there is a global market for oil in the way that there is not a global market for gas. So transportation is not really a limiting factor. Tankers operate all over the world, transport oil over long distances, and so that isn't I think, a bar to selling the oil. It may be that Canada will ultimately find a way to sell more of its oil. I remind you that they're selling less than their current capacity. The current pipeline capacity to the United States is greater than what they're actually producing at this point in time. Keystone will only add to that. So they haven't even reached the maximum that they could reach with the existing pipeline capacity to the United States. So
let's give Dan
sure.
Simmons a chance to weigh in here on these
sure.
points, and then we've got quite a few other callers lined up, so
okay.
Then we'll move on to our next caller. But Mr. Simmons, do you have something to say on these points?
Just one thing quick. As Professor Squillace noted about the EIS, that you know he noted there were a number of things that he didn't feel like that the EIS had necessarily covered, and it's one of the real challenges. It's why it took more than 3 years when it seems like this question should be pretty simple, at least to my mind, to look at that. And it was really, I think, the strategic mistake that Congress made with when they passed the law requiring President Obama to make a decision within 3 months. And that was they didn't waive NEPA. If they would have waived NEPA, President Obama would have been in more of a box and having to make a decision. But as it was, it was much easier for President Obama to say, you know, to reject the pipeline because there was no possible way that he could, that the administration could satisfy NEPA in that shortened time frame, and so there was nothing that President Obama could do, I think, other than reject the pipeline.
Let's go to our next question from our next caller.
Hey, this is Professor Rod Sullivan at Florida Coastal School of Law. I wanted to address this topic of the cost of transportation in terms of greenhouse gases of fuel oil, and as one of the prior speakers, you know, correctly analyzed, once you build a pipeline, transportation produces no greenhouse gases. I think the professor from Colorado made the point that the transportation of oil was insignificant as a source of greenhouse gases, and I totally disagree with that. 8% of world transportation or greenhouse gases around the world is produced by transportation. 4% of that, or half of that, is maritime transportation. And the thing about maritime transportation is there's no substantial way you can reduce the amount of greenhouse gases. So currently we're putting crude oil on tankers in the Persian Gulf and transporting it to the U.S. Gulf. We're taking crude oil at Valdez, Alaska, and transporting it to L.A. area. We're taking crude oil from Nigeria and Venezuela and bringing it to the U.S. Gulf. And every single one of those ships is producing huge amounts of greenhouse gases coming here full, and then an equal amount of greenhouse gases going back to their loading port empty. So you have, I think, quite frankly, that when the EIS puts pen to paper and compares the greenhouse gases produced by producing oil from tar sands and putting in a pipeline with the greenhouse gases produced by transporting crude oil to the United States from all these foreign countries, we're going to see the Obama administration is actually damaging the environment from a greenhouse gas perspective by blocking the pipeline. And if they were truly environmentally friendly, they'd tell TransCanada to go forward as quickly as possible, finish the pipeline, and start eliminating the transportation of crude oil by tanker to the United States.
Mr. Simmons or Professor Scalacci, you want to respond to that?
I suppose that this is Mark Scalacci. I suppose that I should offer at least an initial response to it. I think it's a good point, and if I suggested that there were no greenhouse gas emissions associated with transportation, that was not my intent. I think that that's a fair point that was made. I think that the global price of oil, though, does suggest that the costs of transportation are not driving the price of oil. They are a factor that needs to be considered. The point I would make in response, though, is that if your analysis is correct about the additional greenhouse gases that are emitted from transportation as compared with the additional greenhouse gas emissions that are related to the nature of this particular resource, I'd like to see that in the environmental impact assessment. I really disagree with Dr. Simmons on this point. I think it would be totally wrong for the federal government to ignore its obligations under NEPA to let us know before we make a decision what the costs of going forward are going to be. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty in this area, and no assessment is going to be perfect. I'm not seeking perfection. As I said, I've not necessarily decided that this is a bad idea to build the pipeline. I do think, though, that we don't have adequate information at this point in time to make an intelligent decision regarding whether this is in the national interest.
And I don't disagree that if they're going to redo the EIS that it should include this. I guess what I see is bureaucratic inertia on behalf of the administration in refusing to acknowledge that the building of a pipeline saves greenhouse gases in other areas. And until they're willing to acknowledge that and put a pen to paper and calculate what that is, they're going to be giving a false assessment to the environmental impact of this pipeline.
Mr. Simmons, you want to weigh in on this point?
I don't have anything to add.
Okay. We have a couple more people lined up. Let's go to the next question.
Hi, this is Mario Loyola, Texas Public Policy Foundation. I'd just like both of the experts to address, if they could, what seems to me the crucial difference between scarcity pricing and commodity pricing when you have world demand is now up to 89 million barrels per day this year, but reserve capacity is only about a million or two barrels per day. One of the talking points that I've heard from opponents of the Keystone XL pipeline is that it's just, you know, Keystone's only 700,000 or a million barrels extra, but in the context of scarcity pricing, that can really make a huge difference. We had, before the recession, world demand peaked at, I think it was 86 million barrels per day, and in the course of the recession, it fell by about a million barrels, but the price of gasoline fell by half at the pump just because of that fall in demand. So I'd like to know, both of the experts, if they could, to just give their assessment of how much more important something like the Keystone Pipeline can be when worldwide reserve capacity is down to such low levels as we see today.
This is Dan Simmons, and I just add that, I mean, one of the reasons that we saw it last year with the spike in the price of gasoline was because there was it's not that Libya's million barrels of oil per day of production, you know, meant everything to the world market, but one of the reasons that it shocked the market as it did is because of the lack of reserve capacity, and the fact that most of the reserve capacity in oil production is in the Middle East and in Saudi Arabia. It's one of the reasons that I think that the having greater access to the oil sands is a good thing, because it means that there could be more of a cushion when we have events such as the strife in the Middle East and with the situation with Iran and possibly shutting off the Straits of Hormuz. Those are important issues, because when we have there was some conversation about natural gas and about how natural gas prices have are much lower in the United States than they used to be. Just a few years ago, the United States had some of the world's highest spot prices for natural gas, but because the natural gas market around the world is not as developed as in transporting natural gas by liquefying natural gas, isn't nearly as developed as oil, the United States, our increase of natural gas production has caused natural gas prices to go, to about 230 per million BTUs, which is an incredible drop over a few years. So the more spare capacity that the market has, I think, will add price stability. Obviously, the Keystone XL is not the end-all, be-all of energy security, but the bigger point is that I think it helps, and that is the more things that we can do to have more oil being produced by stable countries, countries that are our friends, would add to price stability. There's no silver bullet to that issue, but this is one approach that would help, I believe.
Professor, do you want to weigh in on this?
Sure. Just briefly, I think it's a valid point that the caller makes, and certainly, it's another one of these issues that was not addressed, I don't believe, in the environmental impact statement. It would be worth considering the potential value of additional supplies to stabilize the price. I'd note a couple things, though. The thing that would most serve, I think, the national interest in terms of increasing our security would be to continue on the trend that we're on now to reduce our consumption of oil. You know, some projections suggest that we can achieve reductions of over 4 billion barrels per day by the year 2030, maybe even better than that. I've seen one projection suggesting we can get down to 4.6. A lot of that's going to come automatically from the increased vehicle mileage standards that we're seeing, and that's really going to help a lot. I also think it's important to recognize that while price stability may be important, reducing the price of gasoline, even though that's the popular political thing to do, is not necessarily the best thing to do in terms of trying to move ourselves away from what I think most people acknowledge is not going to be the fuel of the future. And so there's a delicate balance, I think, to be sort of walked here. And I just don't know whether the additional production that is provided by the Keystone Pipeline is really going to provide us with the kind of security that I think some of the proponents of it are claiming.
All right, we have another question.
Hi, this is Gary Wheaton from the Massachusetts School of Law. I'm just a student, so quick question. What's obvious to me is that there seems to be this artificial pressure to push pricing of oil up with what the professor just said, and I understand that. But isn't there always already thousands and thousands of miles of pipelines already? And we've done 3.5 years of environmental studies on this one. So if we artificially make it difficult to add more pipelines and do whatever else it is to increase the price of oil, doesn't that take money out of the economy that you could be using to invest in alternative sources?
Who wants to respond to that?
Yeah, so I guess I'll respond to that. This is Mark Scolacci again. I think just the opposite, and so the key factor in determining whether we're going to produce alternate energy is the price of oil, to some extent the price of gas as well, but certainly if the price of oil comes down, it becomes much more competitive vis-a-vis other renewable kinds of fuels. What the thing that will help production of renewable energy sources and increases in efficiency, I think, are increased price of oil. I'm not advocating an increased price of oil, but certainly we watch all the time how purchases are made for new vehicles when the price of oil spikes. We see the demand for smaller cars, for hybrid cars, more efficient cars going up as the price of fuel spikes. And so again, there's no perfect sort of answer here or solution. Again, I want to emphasize I'm not necessarily saying Keystone's a bad idea. But I think there are a lot of unanswered questions, and I think the caller points to one of them. Is this really what's going to get us to the energy future that we want?
Mr. Simmons?
And one thing about the energy future, we don't know what the future holds. I mean, that's obvious. And so one of the challenges or one of the problems with policies that artificially increase the price of oil is, as the caller mentioned, is that it takes money out of the economy that could be used for other things, and I think that's a problem. There's enough oil in the United States, in North America, to satisfy our current rates of use for a couple hundred years. How long we're going to use that, I have no idea, and it is certainly true that when the price of oil increases, people vote with their dollars and they vote for more fuel efficient vehicles. But it's also true that what matters is that there is real competition, and you're seeing that right now with, for example, I saw some sales figures over the weekend that compared the Chevy Volt to the Prius. The new Prius, I cannot think of the name.
Plug-in?
The Prius C.
Right.
Yes, where it sold more in, I believe, 3 days than the Volt sold all last month. And I think that one of the major differences there, is that when you one is was heavily subsidized by the federal government, the other is not, and so it's what is winning is the better vehicle. So you know, competition matters. The federal government in 2007 they passed the EISA. I'm spacing on what that stands for. The Energy Security. It's not exactly right, Energy Security Act 2007. But what it did is it mandated that we use a certain amount of cellulosic ethanol. And because it was thought at the time by President Bush, by people in Congress, that by now we could be producing hundreds of millions of gallons of cellulosic ethanol commercially. Well, last year it isn't obvious that we produced, the United States, that is, produced a single gallon of ethanol commercially, even though the mandate in the law is to produce a half billion gallons this year. So we don't know. I mean, that's just like one cautionary example. As we think about the energy future, we don't know what that future is going to look like. And so that's why it's my preference that we have lower prices so that the economy has more money to spend on things such as the Prius C. And on these products that actually that people are willing to pay more with because they are superior products.
Professor, do you want to respond?
No, I'm happy to go on to the next question.
Okay. Looks like we do have one more question at least.
Yes, I'd like the guest there to address a couple of questions. I guess I'd like to follow the money. Why doesn't Canada just build at the Vancouver? And, you know, is there some environmental reason there, why they're not doing it? And what is the incentive for TransCanada to build it through the U.S. financially? Do they get some kind of a better deal? Is it cheaper to build it there? Is there a better deal for them when the oil gets sold down at Port Arthur versus somewhere in Vancouver? What are the money incentives here for people to be making the decisions that they're making?
This is Dan Simmons. I'll answer that to the extent that I can. As I understand the Canadian government, in the Canadian provinces are much more they're much more powerful in their system of government than states are. As a result, British Columbia is more they're greener than Alberta, and it's actually pretty difficult. It would be pretty difficult politically to build a pipeline to Vancouver. That's as I understand it. I think that also, I don't know money-wise why they would. I mean, other than increased difficulties in building it across British Columbia, I don't know any money reasons why they would be building it to the U.S. Other than the U.S. has the refining capacity and we have refineries that can take the oil and can refine it. That's all I know.
Yeah, just briefly, and I don't know a whole lot more than Dan does here, but I would say that it seems somewhat ironic that we are at least talking about approving a pipeline almost three times as long as the length of the pipeline that would be needed to go to the West Coast, and because it appears that British Columbia is opposed to it, and for the same reasons that some people are opposing the pipeline through Canada, or at least for some of the very similar reasons that are there. So that's just an interesting, I think, data point that we all ought to think about. Regarding the taxes, I certainly don't consider myself a tax expert or the incentive issue, I think, that was raised. But my understanding is that there is a significant advantage to TransCanada to send the bitumen to Port Arthur because it is considered a foreign trade zone where they can avoid paying what they would otherwise be required to pay in U.S. taxes. And so the U.S. government is not benefiting in the way that they would if this production was occurring domestically and it was being produced outside of a foreign trade zone. I think that there are some incentives certainly for TransCanada to do it through us, and fair for us to ask whether, if it's not in the national interest for Canada to build it through British Columbia, why is it in the national interest of the United States to build it through our country?
All right, let's turn to the next caller then.
Hi, I'm Steve Baraki. I'm non-practicing, but I'm in the oil industry for the last 13 years, and I'm actually a supplier to three of the refineries that shut down on the East Coast recently, from St. Croix, the two in Philadelphia. I've got a lot of experience in the business, and you know, as far as the pipeline, we've got pipelines all over the country, and they're really quite safe. We've got them all from Houston up to New York right now. I'm at Linden, New Jersey, where it's a big one. But the other issue that one of the previous callers, a couple of them made, that I totally agree with, is the surplus of oil in the world is only about 1 million barrels a day. If we make more oil, crude oil gets cheaper. We're not shutting down refineries because they can afford to buy the sweet crude oil that they're meant to produce, which is a little easier on the environment to begin with. When we chase all of our oil-producing ability out of this country and go somewhere else to other countries where we have no control over what they do to the environment, it seems like it's really a specious argument to me. So the answer is really producing more crude. Let this happen. Let the market drive it. Sure, we need controls to be responsible, but you know, there's thousands of jobs at stake, and we have about 700,000 barrels of capacity right now that we lost in the Northeast, just in the last several months, and it's causing an increased cost for the entire economy up here and nationwide, which is not certainly detrimental to the rest of our citizens. That's all I really have to say.
Either one of our experts want to respond.
Mark Scalacci, I'll take a crack. I think it's a good point, and you know, I think the question about the pipeline itself is not really the big issue here. At least it's not for me. I know that's one of the big issues that the environmental community has been raising, but there are lots of issues here, I think, that have not been fully addressed, and lots of externalities, as I mentioned at the beginning of this call, that I think ought to be fully analyzed and accounted for before we go forward with this decision. I think the point about the refineries is a good one, and we do need to figure out a way to increase refining capacity in the United States, and particularly on the East Coast. I mean, some of these air pollution regulations that are kicking in are pushing some of the refineries out of business, and there certainly are some advantages in terms of clean air and the health impacts from shutting down some of those old refineries. But it's difficult to get a new refinery approved, and I think that there may need to be some effort to assist companies in getting additional refinery capacity. So I think that the caller makes a good point. This whole question about the commodity pricing and the scarcity issue, I think, is one that I would defer to other economists on that. I know the United States has been talking, though, with Saudi Arabia about increasing their production. There does seem to be some additional capacity in different parts of the world that is at least at this point not tapped, and I don't know that that is necessarily what's driving the current price of oil.
Mr. Simmons?
What I would just add is, as a number of callers have mentioned, is, the importance of the price of oil, and that is why this has been such a big issue politically, is that it's a part of the economy that affects everyone, and that everyone is concerned about high oil prices. It's why this will continue to be an issue through the election, just because everyone is concerned about the price of oil. Keystone XL is a touchstone politically. And because people see it as, a majority of Americans want to see the pipeline be built, and disagree with President Obama on that issue, and then you couple that with rising gas prices, which is why the president this week is going to be talking about his energy policies. It's just energy issues are core to the economy, and they're definitely core to getting the economy moving again. It's just one quick observation that it'll play a big part in the national politics for the next year or so, at least.
Could I just add a comment about that? I think that's basically right. But I would say that we talk about oil as if it were operating in some kind of perfect market, and that's far from true. We all know that the price of oil, to a large extent, depends upon speculation and people's perception about the conditions in the world, particularly in the Middle East. And the spikes that we've seen have come at a time when production is up and when demand is down. So it's not following a clear supply-demand kind of curve in terms of the price. It's rather being promoted by speculators who are driving the price up in part because of concerns about what could be happening in the Middle East and some tensions there. So I think we just need to keep that in mind. I don't know that there's anything we can particularly do about that. I don't think building the Keystone Pipeline is necessarily going to fix that problem, certainly not in the short term, because it will be many years before that actually would come online, even if it were approved today. So we just, I think those are important caveats about decisions like this.
Oh, and this is Dan Simmons again. One comment I would make to that is that, one of the concerns I think that there is in the, commodity traders and oil traders is that, there doesn't, from the administration, there doesn't seem to be any impetus to really increase U.S. production of oil, that rather they seem hostile to the production of oil given their decision on Keystone XL, the slowdown of permits in the Gulf, because it isn't, it is in the long run, it's supply and demand. In the shorter run, people's expectations definitely matter with regards to the price of oil. And I think that is part of what is driving the price of oil up. In the short run, you could approve the Keystone XL pipeline. It wouldn't have any impact at all on the supply, but it would have an impact on people's perceptions of the future supply. And that definitely figures into people's, into the speculators' opinions about what you're going to see prices in the future.
I want to comment on that, too, if I can. This is Mark again. I think that's a good point, Dan. But I would say that the perception plays out, too, with respect to claims that are made about the Obama administration's hostility to oil. In fact, we know that oil production is up in the United States. It's been up every year that Obama's been in office, in large part because of the continued development in the Bakken Shale in primarily in North Dakota, where we've seen, I think they're producing well over 500,000 barrels per day, and the projections are it's going to increase dramatically from there. So production is going up in this country, has been going up. It's really some of the counter evidence to that claim is based upon the reduction in interest in gas, because the gas companies can't make a profit on many of the gas plays that historically have been at stake. So, I think we just need to be careful about the facts here, and it's obviously a very complicated issue, and I hope we can keep in mind that perception is not necessarily reality.
All right, it looks like we have two more questions from our audience, so let's try and get to those before we run out of time here.
Hi, this is Mario Loyola again. I just wanted to respond to something that Professor Scalacci said, and just with all due respect to point out that a great many of us regard the argument about speculators driving up prices as exceedingly specious. And just to point out, without even claiming to be right, just a lot of us think that argument is, and I'm familiar with, for example, very familiar with the current government in Venezuela. Every time they put in a price control, it leads to scarcity, and then they blame speculators. That pattern, which is more typical of third world politics than of politics in the Western world, we could have seen it coming. As soon as administration policies that have been, as Dan Simmons said, somewhat hostile to increased oil production, whether they produce the intended results or whether the intended result came from just the basic laws of supply and demand and constricted reserve capacity and rising demand in Asia, we now have the higher gasoline prices that the administration said it wanted from the very beginning. And with, America's working families feeling the pain of gasoline above $4 a gallon with worse to come, you can see it coming a mile away that, that people on certain parts of the political spectrum are going to start blaming speculators. And so I just want to impress on folks that whatever the evidence is that prices have not been following global trends in supply and demand, I'd love to see it. I have somewhat more than a passing familiarity with the evidence, and the broad outlines have always been in keeping with the general trends in supply and demand. Of course, there's instability in the Middle East, more now than the normal instability in the Middle East, and people worry about supply disruptions. People worry about losing for temporary periods of time 2.5 million barrels a day of Iranian exports. That's only twice what we would be getting to the Gulf through the Keystone pipeline. So,
Professor, let me break in there and see if Professor Scolacci wants to respond.
Yes, I actually don't. I think we'll just have to agree to disagree on that point. I think that there is plenty of evidence that speculation is playing a role in price, but let's. I think we'll just have to leave it at that. That's another big conversation.
Okay, we've got one final question, one more caller question. Let's go to that.
Professor Scolacci, I was the first caller and realized I sort of challenged you anonymously. Sorry for that. My name is John Melko. With regard to the last caller, I do think that speculation has some effect on pricing, and I think, though, that part of that speculation is due to what I would characterize as a lack of energy policy. And as a number of callers have pointed out, right now, really the only spare capacity in the system that's accessible is this million barrels a day or so that Saudi Arabia thinks it can produce. And that's by no means certain. Thank you.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the caller was going to this point, but I think the fair point that was made is that we do need a comprehensive energy policy. We ought to have a roadmap to where we think we're going to go. It's just very difficult, I think, for anybody to do in the sort of partisan political climate that we have operating today. I think the Obama administration is interested and would like to see a more comprehensive policy. I don't think that there is agreement among members of Congress about what that policy should look like, and it may be difficult to get to a policy that would serve the broad interests of the country.
Let me, this is Dean Reuter again. Let me give each of you 30 seconds or so to wrap up. We're just about out of time here, but also see if you want to address what are the next steps for the Keystone Pipeline procedurally. What does the future look like? What does it hold? And let's start with Professor Scolacci.
Sure. So I think we don't know really where things are going with the Keystone Pipeline. I would frankly not be surprised to see that it ultimately is built. I think there are arguments for it that the administration may ultimately find compelling. I'd like to see better information addressed than has been currently addressed in the EIS. I hope that happens. I hope that the questions that have been raised can be adequately responded to. I guess time will tell whether or not that happens. But I think the broader question that this call or this teleforum has raised is just whether or not we need some broader sort of view about how to solve our problems with oil supplies and more broadly with the energy policy itself.
Mr. Simmons, a final thought.
I agree with Professor Scolacci that, it's really tough to see what happens with the Keystone Pipeline if there is a Republican president elected. I'm sure they will approve the Keystone Pipeline as out of course, because it will be a huge political issue. The issue with Keystone is really not necessarily an issue. I think it's the issue is completely in the political arena at this point. The Obama administration approved another oil sands pipeline previous to this one that started off an environmental firestorm that we saw culminate last year, and now it's a political football. So really, it's a political issue, and that it will just continue to be a political issue going into this year when everything becomes hyper-partisan and the price of gasoline just makes it even more so.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both for your participation in our call today. We certainly appreciate your time and your remarks. Let me thank our audience as well for their thoughtful questions and for their time. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.